Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll examine the nation's transportation policy. First, we'll take a look at where the government spends our money. Funding for public transport, passenger trains, and alternative transportation has declined in recent years, while highway spending has risen. Then we'll take a look at Chrysler's new electric car. Just a couple of months ago, Chrysler complained that the technology wasn't good enough for the marketplace. Now, they and other big three automakers are racing to get their cars to the showrooms. And on our Earth calendar, we'll make the annual newt migration in the hills of Northern California. Each year, these four-legged creatures can be found in writhing bunches as they prepare to mate. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. I've always had fun thinking about what an archaeologist from a distant solar system a few million years from now would think if she set out to explore a continent known as America on a dead planet Earth. She might conclude that the dominant force in this distant and now extinct society was a four-wheeled machine called Otto. So sophisticated was this Otto organism that it carried a lesser life form known as humans in its belly to secure nourishment for the Otto when its onboard supply ran out. Finally, this Otto creature caused humans to build whole communities, which featured ramps and resting places and vast Otto graveyards. Thomas Lally examines our current transportation policy to see whether the conclusions of our mythical archaeologist can be avoided.
For nearly everyone in this country, getting somewhere means driving in a car. Since the early part of the century, the automobile has been America's favorite mode of transportation. But it's expensive. Each year, we spend hundreds of billions of dollars building and repairing roads, billions more on cars, and even more on gasoline. But times are changing. Michael Replogle is an expert on transportation policy for the Environmental Defense Fund. He says the nation's transportation game plan is beginning to take alternative modes into account.
U.S. transportation policy is at a crossroads, but we have to ensure that our transportation systems don't just favor road construction and old ways of thinking. We have to reorient our transportation to build sustainable communities, and more sustainable transportation.
Replogle's vision was partially realized in 1991 with the passage of the Intermodal Surface Transportation Act, or ICE-T. This bill allows local governments to choose how some transportation money is spent. In the past, most of this money was used to build roads. Now, for instance, a community can take some highway money and spend it on sidewalks, bike trails, or public transportation. But some feel highway money should be left alone. Paul Kerhoven is the manager for environmental affairs at the Highway Users Federation. He says many alternative transportation projects are unsuccessful.
In Chicago, they spent $12 million for a bicycle path. Now, I think, if I remember right, Chicago just got hit with a tremendous blizzard, and I'm wondering how many people really are spending their time on a bicycle right now to drive, you know, to get into Chicago.
But Replogle points out that the number of cars has increased three times faster than the population in general. This means more and more pollution. He says we need to find new ways to move people around.
The car is a wonderful way to get around, but it takes us where we want to go, when we want to go. But if all of us use the car for all of our trips, we all end up stuck in terrible traffic jams too much of the time. There's simply not enough money in public coffers to fund transportation and keep up with the growth in driving. This is not sustainable from an environmental or an economic standpoint.
While cars have enjoyed the lion's share of transportation money, even enjoying a 0.5% increase in funding this year, other forms of transportation have seen deep cuts. This year, Amtrak once again suffered a reduction in funding. Many are now talking about privatizing Amtrak, arguing that it should be able to survive in a free market system. Scott Leonard is the assistant director for the National Association of Railroad Passengers. He says privatization makes no sense.
If free enterprise, a free market public enterprise is so great, then why don't we do that for the other modes? Why don't we pass a bill that says all municipalities and states that own airports need to privatize them and sell them and get out of the transportation business? Why don't we have Congress pass a law that says all municipalities and states that own highways sell them and get out of the highway business? You never hear anybody ask the question why I-90 across Montana doesn't make a profit for the government that owns it.
But whatever happens with Amtrak, highway interests say hands off their appropriations. Kerhoven says his organization has concluded that even if Amtrak were phased out, it wouldn't make much of a difference. But Scott Leonard argues that virtually all public transportation projects, whether they be highways or subways, lose money. In the case of Amtrak, he said, it will not survive privatization.
If Amtrak is not subsidized, the only alternative is to not have passenger trains. We have had a system in the past of a purely private sector passenger train system that did not receive subsidies, and it died, competing with airplanes that used publicly owned airports and highways, or automobiles that used publicly owned highways, and they couldn't do it.
Transportation policy is fairly well established for this congressional session, but next session, ICE-T and other provisions which encourage alternative transportation may be on the table. The need for transportation spending is obvious. Each year, the number of cars increases and existing roads continue to carry many times their intended load. Billions will be spent to alleviate this stress. The question is whether we will trade a portion of our dependence on automobiles for something else. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. More than anything else, transportation policy is shaped by the Federal Intermodal Surface Transportation Act, known as ICE-T. It was passed 4 years ago as a way to revamp transportation policy by giving localities more power in deciding where federal money gets spent. But ICE-T will be up for reauthorization soon, and many changes are expected. The question is, how should it change? Joining us are Michael Replogle, a transportation expert with the Environmental Defense Fund, a national environmental group, and Taylor Bolden, Vice President for Policy of the Highway Users Federation, a trade association for the highway user community. Mr. Replogle.
Well, ICE-T should be reauthorized, favoring the principles of flexibility, accountability, efficiency, equity, and openness on which the original law was based. The local role in decision-making must be strengthened, and all forms of travel should have equal access to transportation funds. The public needs better information on how governments spend the $20 billion in funds provided under ICE-T every year. We need to make sure potholes are getting filled before money is spent on new or wider roads. We need to ensure that transportation spending will reduce pollution and public health problems. These objectives will help us strengthen our economy, communities, and environment.
Mr. Bolden.
We believe that ICE-T reauthorization ought to begin with identifying the federal interest in transportation, and that interest is in serving interstate commerce and national defense needs. Congress and the President just signed into law the National Highway System, which serves those interstate commerce and national defense needs, and that's where we would focus most of the federal funds and oversight in a new ICE-T. In addition to those highways, we'd put money into bridges and a safety program. We would also give the states a block grant to finance their state and local transportation priorities and give them as much flexibility and as little red tape with those block grant funds as possible. Beyond that, if there are any federal taxes left that aren't used in those programs, we'd cut the federal highway tax and give the states a larger tax base to work with.
Mr. Replogle, in reply.
The states and highway users today, many of them are seeking access to $20 billion without any accountability for how the money is spent. The federal interest and the interest of all citizens extends beyond the interstate highways into the effect of all the transportation spending on our local communities. And federal clean air laws, clean water laws, and the need to assure public involvement in planning can only be protected effectively by including these as requirements in our federal transportation law.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have heard Mr. Replogle from the Environmental Defense Fund, and we have heard Mr. Bolden from the Highway Users Federation. The holiday season is upon us. This is traditionally a time when American consumption reaches its apex. But there are alternatives to a holiday season filled with disposable consumer goods. You can give cash to be invested in green mutual funds or businesses. You can give yourself and the environment a boost through green investments in your IRA. Evan Conroy, Development Director of Co-op America, tells us how it is done.
Virtually every financial instrument that one uses can be obtained through a socially responsible source, everywhere from your banking to your savings to your credit cards to your mutual funds or investments. There are a plethora of services out there.
But while shares in a green mutual fund are something everyone can use, the holidays are a lot more than money or consumer items. Environment Show reporter Linda Anderson has these comments on what the holidays really mean.
When the holidays arrive, many people hope to have the opportunity to step away from their anxiety-ridden and hurried lives. But what happens instead is our already hectic lives become intensified. Panicked, people race around in their cars to shop the malls, hoping to knock off all the gifts on their list. The holiday can be what you make it, and perhaps the more conscious your decision about how to spend it, the more satisfying the results. Consider that making your holiday a peaceful one might be as simple an act as turning off your TV. Just say no. By scaling down, you can create a holiday that is not only a whole lot happier, but more sustainable as well. Forget all the driving and all the junk. By focusing more on the process and establishing limitations, you just may free yourself up to create a more home-centered Christmas with family and friends, which is, after all, the main ingredient for this season. This is the darkest time of the year, and it is no surprise that we draw close, choosing the company of others to bring light and merriment into our lives. Consider, it may just be enough to gather together, renew our hope, and celebrate our place on this earth. Happy holidays, everyone.
Los Angeles is famous for its smog, but the Federal Clean Air Act was designed to reduce it. The act requires states to adopt implementation plans, which chart strategies to achieve healthy air. The plan, which California adopted in 1990, not only required better controls on cars to reduce exhaust emissions, but also required that in 1998, 20,000 or 2% of cars sold have no exhaust emissions at all. By the year 2001, the requirement goes up to 50,000 cars, or 5%, and 10% in 2004. The mandate to produce a car with no exhaust has stimulated two responses. One was an intense effort to develop the technology, particularly batteries and recharge capability, to put an electric car on the road and into the marketplace. The other, also pursued by the auto industry with great vigor, was to fight to repeal or delay the zero-emission requirement altogether. On the Environment Show 6 weeks ago, Reg Modlin, manager of environmental and energy planning for the Chrysler Corporation, argued the zero-emission mandate should be eliminated, in part because, as he said,
the technology is not yet available.
This week we caught up with Mr. Modlin at the North American Electric Vehicle Conference in Atlanta, and he had better news.
We're announcing today that we're prepared to start production of an electric version of our minivan. We're going to call the vehicle the Epic, and it'll be produced for Dodge and for Plymouth out of our Windsor Assembly plant. That's Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Our present plans are to start production with this vehicle sometime in 1997.
Meanwhile, in California, the auto industry argues before the California Air Resources Board that the mandate must be lifted because it cannot be met. We hear from Roland Wong, senior analyst for the Union of Concerned Scientists, who has been an advocate for clean air before the California Air Resources Board. He describes the seemingly contradictory assertions of the automakers.
Well, I think what we've been seeing is somewhat of a dual personality of the auto companies. What we've seen recently is auto companies saying exactly the opposite of what they were saying up until very, very recently, which is now they're saying that the mandate cannot be met. But up until very recently, they've been saying that they are on track. They've been telling the Air Resources Board staff they're on track for meeting the mandate.
Sometimes we put too much faith in technology to solve environmental problems, but the unfolding story of the development of the electric vehicle tells us that there are times when the engineers and the governmental relations lobbyists interpret facts differently, even when they work for the same industry. I'm Peter Burley. If you can't fight them, join them. For years, some of the most active and intense lobbying on Capitol Hill has been mounted by the outdoor advertising industry, eager to relax restrictions on where and how billboards may be erected. Equally active resistance to these efforts has been mounted by organizations such as Scenic America. The National Highway System Bill, recently signed by President Clinton, will open up more roadsides for billboards, a win for the advertising industry. But as Bruce Robertson reports, in designing the bill, members of Congress also gave a big win to Scenic America.
For years, the outdoor advertising industry has lobbied hard to allow more billboards everywhere, including along scenic highways. Scenic America, an organization founded in 1982 to push for tougher standards regulating billboards, has lobbied equally hard to resist the expansion. The new National Highway System bill, signed recently by President Clinton, at first glance seems to tip in favor of the billboard industry by allowing more billboards along parts of scenic highways. But Scenic America Policy Director Frank Vespi feels the new bill actually protects scenic routes.
What the legislation will do is allow states, in very unusual and limited circumstances, where you've got a scenic byway that has a section which is... it doesn't have any of the qualities that you designate a road scenic for. It's not scenic. It doesn't have any historic structures, anything like that. And it's got heavy industrial or commercial use. In those very unusual circumstances, a state could segment that part of the road out of the designation and allow billboards there.
But who decides what is scenic and what is not? Vespi says it is in the interests of individual states to answer that question. Kippy Burns represents the Outdoor Advertising Association of America. Burns sees this new legislation a win for advertisers, especially fending off Scenic America, which would have banned advertising along all stretches of scenic routes, including the non-scenic industrial zones. Burns says it is critical that federal law allow states this flexibility.
Every area has different economic development needs that they want to balance with scenic preservation. And keep in mind that the original intent of the Scenic Byways program was to marry development with preservation of scenic areas, because it's difficult to imagine a purely pristine scenic area where no travelers will be able to stop in and buy, stop and shop, stop and eat, stop and sleep. And that's what this is really all about. It's allowing the states and the localities to use outdoor advertising if they feel it's necessary to bring customers into their establishments.
Yet Scenic America clearly feels victorious in stopping the Advertising Association. But Frank Vespi says Scenic America is even more optimistic about another provision in the new federal bill. The new bill calls for a change in highway design and construction techniques, which until now focused almost exclusively on traffic flow and motorist safety.
The way they had designed roads was purely based on those two concerns. And what they essentially said is, okay, our most important customer is a car here. What's best for the car? What they didn't say is what's best for the community, what's best for the people that are served by the road. And a lot of communities across the country found that they were getting roads essentially forced down their throats that were wider than they needed to be, that were straighter than they needed to be. And all of that was resulting in the destruction of historic structures, environmental resources, scenic vistas. And people were saying, wait a minute, this is not what we want. These roads are supposed to serve us, not master us.
The new legislation gives states and localities the option of taking environmental and historic site preservation more prominently into account when building or refurbishing a road. The new transportation bill seeks to establish a national highway system separate from the interstate system. The plan is to build a set of guidelines, safety, and design standards to apply to over 160,000 miles of roads considered the nation's most important thoroughfares. President Clinton said he signed the transportation bill reluctantly because it also turned back to the states the right to set speed limits, set at 55 by President Nixon during the Middle East oil embargo. The president said he feared he did not have enough votes to sustain his veto. What he and we as a nation of motorists got was a bill no one likes completely, but one that is at least partially acceptable to most. This apparently is considered a victory. This is Bruce Robertson.
In our Earth calendar this week, we watch the California newts as they begin their annual migration. Unlike animals which hibernate in the winter, newts estivate, which means they sleep through California's hot, dry summer and are active only in the wet winter season. When the rains begin, newts wake up and, in a process still not understood, head to the waters where they were born. In the hills across the bay from San Francisco, roads in the Tilden Park Nature Area are closed all winter to protect the newts. Before this, as many as 200 newts a day were run over by cars. David Zuckerman is a naturalist at Tilden Park, and he explains what happens when the newts feel the first rains.
Usually what happens with the first rains is that the mature males wake up and they start getting active for the first time of the year. And probably what they do first, before they even get down to the creeks, is they start to forage for food because they've been quiet and they haven't eaten much. And as it turns out, one of their favorite foods is it's very abundant. It's the earthworm, and so they will chow down on a couple of earthworms. And so at this time of year, you'll find males plodding downhill with big bellies. And when you see those guys, you know they've munched on a few earthworms.
As the male newts head downhill, they go through changes. Their skin goes from dry and scaly to moist and slippery. Their tail gets flatter, and the vent area near the pelvis begins to swell with sperm. They also develop rough areas on their palms called nuptial pads. Zuckerman says this is for grabbing the female during mating.
Since there's no females there, the males are kind of primed to do this clasping or this amplexus, and what you have frequently is a bunch of males kind of holding on to each other, and it just becomes this ball of writhing newts that are just kind of rolling around on the bottom of the creek. And sometimes there's one female who's arrived, and she might be in the middle of that while the other males are trying to clasp with her. And this is not mating.
When more females arrive, the balance of the sexes evens out. Females then allow males to ride piggyback as they swim together through the water. Eventually, the male lets go and drops a small packet of sperm, and if the female is interested, she'll swim over, pick it up, and store it in her vent region. When she's ready to lay her eggs, they'll be fertilized. Zuckerman cautions people not to disturb newts. Although they don't bite, their skin is covered with petrotoxin, a poison similar to the one found in the deadly pufferfish. While raccoons have found a way to avoid the toxin by turning the newts inside out before eating them, a newt dinner is not recommended. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 311. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.